This is Fresh Air. Studs Terkel's art is getting people to tell the stories of their lives. In collecting their stories, he's revealed the larger story of American life. His books have uncovered memories of the Great Depression and World War II and reflected on how people feel about their work. Studs Terkel is also a familiar voice to many Americans. His nationally syndicated radio show originates in his hometown, Chicago. Before we ask him to talk about his own life, let's find out about his new book, Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. In the introduction, Terkel writes about how people often speak in code when they talk about race. Here's a reading.
It was a slow day. The waitress and I were engaged in idle talk, weather, arthritis, and a whisper of local scandal. And she was large and genial, motherly. The neighborhood was an admixture of middle class and blue collar. On its periphery was an enclave of black families. And as I was leaving, she said, "Of course we're moving. You know why." It was an offhand remark, as casual as "see you around." You know why. Now, during the Boston school crisis some years ago, the leader of the fight against court-ordered busing proclaimed, "You know where I stand." You know where I stand. In Chicago, during the black mayor's first campaign, his white opponent's slogan was, "Before it's too late." Before it's too late. And then I ask, and that sets up the book, why were these people speaking in code? Why didn't the waitress tell us why? Where did the Boston mother stand? Why didn't the Chicago candidate tell us what it might be too late for? There was no need. All of us, black and white, know what it's about. Yet why the veiled language? And then it goes on.
Well, why do you think people use that veiled language?
Because deep down, this is my feeling, what I call the slender reed of hope. Even the most virulent of white racists, and I'm not denying there's a form of racism among blacks, we can come to that. It may not be. Perhaps it's something else. Because blacks, many would say, it can't be racism unless institutional racism as well. But back to the key aspect, which is attitudes of whites toward blacks, which more or less sets everything up, anyway, from the very beginning, 400 years ago. And there's a woman, I see some people I haven't seen for 25 years, revisit them. And this young woman, young mother, now middle-ish, defied the community. It was an ethnic community, and they were afraid of blacks and anti, and she used to bring her friends in, and they were black all that. She defied them. She felt her kids should be more open than her mother and father were. But today, she's a little different. She does work that involves violations of laws. She's an investigator. And so she sees all people at their worst. But she says today she feels less sure, or less sympathetic to blacks, still, but less. And she, at the same time as she says that, I know I shouldn't feel that way. You know, I'm a good Christian woman, and I know this is a wrong feeling. So almost everyone adds that little caveat to what they're saying, or that little moderating phrase. It's what my feeling makes me uncomfortable. They know deep down there's something wrong with it. And that, to me, is a note of hope. It's not always the case, but it's there. I sense that. It's a recurring theme.
Studs Terkel, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about you. And forgive me if this will be a little bit contrived, but what I'd like to do is use the subjects that you've done books about and see how those subjects have affected you in your life. Let's start with Hard Times, your oral history of the Great Depression. How did your family do during the Depression?
Well, okay. We had a little hotel. It was a men's hotel in the heart of Chicago. Wells, I love the name, Wells Grand Hotel. And now I'm happy to see an SRO, a single room occupancy, a very nice place. I noticed that. We had a hard time. There was never a vacancy sign, never. It was full. These were working men. I see a men's hotel, your first reaction is flophouse. It was the opposite. Back in the 20s, there were a lot of transient workmen and skilled craftsmen. They lived at this place. But then came the 30s, then came the Depression, and bit by bit we find the guys in the lobby. Then they start to drink some more, and there were fights breaking out. And bit by bit they thought less of themselves. And then we had the vacancy sign. more. But we finally sold the hotel, not very much, but got along. And then I went to law school. You know, don't ask me why, but I did. I went because I dreamed of Clarence Darrow, you know. And I woke up to Julius Hoffman. That's a Chicago joke. And he was the judge during the conspiracy trial. But I dreamed of, you know, defending the underdog. That was the dream, you know. And then I get torts and contracts, and I went crazy. So my dream was to have a civil service job, 9 to 5. What better? A depression boy. And I did have a civil service job for 6 months, and again went crazy because I was counting baby bonds, which is a World War One, a payoff to World War One vets. And came back to Chicago as part of a labor theater group, for want of something. Was on the WPA, the Writers Project. That's how I learned to write. And then became, in the meantime, an actor in soap operas. I was the gangster.
Well, this is getting into the territory of your book of oral histories, Working. So let me ask you about work that you've done over the years. How did you, you started off in soap operas, and how did you start doing interviews?
Accidentally. Gee, how can I? I think living at the hotel played a role, if I, just as a preface to it.
Oh, because there were all these strangers, and you had to learn how to talk to strangers.
Delight, I must say that my boyhood was a very delightful one. How could it not be? I was the one kid in the whole lobby, and these guys are talking, and I hear everything. So, but then I was disc jockey, and now I began to interview somebody, a folk singer, Maria Miranda, or Pete Seeger, Pete in his younger days, or Woody Guthrie, the man. Lead Belly. These are people I had on the program, I knew. And then from that, a woman once called and said, you should do more interviewing with people. I said, why? Well, because there's something, I don't know what, there's something different. Try it. So I did. And so went on to, one thing led to another, until finally I did stuff on this radio station, WFMT, where I've been for 40 years.
My guest is Studs Terkel. He has a new book of oral histories called Race. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Studs Terkel, and his new book of oral histories is called Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. You had an oral history called The Good War about World War II. Were you ever in the military?
1 year stateside, nothing. Called limited service. And I did in special services, meaning you write speeches for people and do entertainment, just a year here. So, but nonetheless got an idea of the young GIs, the kids who were going and doing stuff.
What year was this?
1942 to 1943.
So it was while World War II.
Oh, yeah. Was on. Oh, yeah. The Good War. It's called, by the way, you know, the adjective and the noun. I have that, you know, in quotes. Because guys speak, I was in the good war. Well, of course, in contrast to Vietnam, anything is good. That is, tuberculosis is good in contrast to cancer, see. But the good war is a reference to the war against fascism, of course. But the good and war don't match anyway, never does. Even that so-called good war is horrendous and makes savages of everyone who participates, no matter what side they're on.
Would you have been willing to fight in World War II?
Oh, yeah, I spoke. Oh, yeah. Strangely enough, I can even, this may be hindsight. Oh, sure. Because it was, remember, it was a dream. There was a dream of a better world. The New Deal was there. And then, of course, there was Hitler. And Mussolini was certainly Hitler. And I almost went to Spain in 1936. I was tempted. My mother and I had a big fight. To fight for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, part of the International Brigade against fascism, Franco, and almost went there. That would be 36.
I have a copy of your memoir, Talking to Myself, in front of me. This is from, I think, 1977. And you're standing on a city street smoking a cigar. Are you still smoking cigars?
Oh, yeah, but I have to do it privately now. And I respect, because it's a foul-smelling weed, and it's a vile habit, but I love it. But I do. But I got to close the doors now.
Well, who's stopping you?
No, I hear complaints from my colleagues, from my wife, of course, and from everybody. And they're right, because there is the... I do believe in that secondary catching of it, you know, and it's foul smelling. Let's face it.
You've been interviewed so much over the years. Have you been interviewed by journalists who you felt violated some of the ground rules that you follow when you interview somebody else?
Well, they don't try it on me. If they do, I just pay no attention. I don't. You mean like very personal stuff?
Yeah, because you have this thing about not violating, not trespassing on somebody's privacy.
I think that comes back to the Wells Grand Hotel again days. I just feel it. I'm no admirer of Clinton. I'm not of his labor, but that has nothing to do with his personal life. I mean, I don't admire his anti-labor policies of the state of in Arkansas or is going down there to see a retarded guy executed. But the other stuff I find absolutely reprehensible. I mean, the going into it, as I did in the Gary Hart case. I find this. Remember the play the Best Man by Gore Vidal?
No, I've never read it.
It dealt with two candidates for president. It was a good play. And one is he's a very enlightened guy who happens to have a mistress. He's married. But he's wonderful on social programs and humanity. The other guy is a wrong open, the year one genuflex before corrupt big boys and is a warlike guy, but is very faithful to his wife and goes to church every Sunday. Who's the best man? And so that should be the way of judging things, to me. And so I find, coming back to the way I things I consider inviolate, as I do, I find this incredible.
So when a journalist asks you a question that you think is too personal, what do you say?
I just ignore it. I just say, no, I don't care to answer it. It's demeaning to you as well as to me, something in that vein.
And what kinds of questions would you say that to?
Well, very personal questions about personal life, you know. But your sexual life or something like that. Something in that vein, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Or a relationship to, let's say, my son, or something like that. And I say, my son wants to live his life. He wants to be independent. And what's he do? I say what he does. Well, how come he's not doing what you're doing? Well, it's really none of your business. Something in that vein.
Mm-hmm. What do you consider to be the bravest thing you've ever done in your life? And I don't necessarily mean physically brave. It could be a decision that you made.
It's not brave. It's ego. The one when, I suppose, when the show was up for grabs, Studs Place. It was a very popular TV show, along with Garraway at Large and Cooker, Frey, and Ollie. The early days of TV, 1950, considered. It was called Chicago. It was called TV Chicago Style. And then came the McCarthy days, and my name was on many petitions that I signed. And many of those petitions, I'm sure, were begun by communists, you know, anti-Jim Crow, freedom of the Soviet Union, price control. And sure enough, I was on the list. And I was called in. They were going to drop Studs Place. It was a popular show. A guy came in from the network, NBC, I forget his name, to see me. They said, you know, you're a valuable property. I like that word, valuable property. But you're in trouble. But all you have to do is to say you were duped. I mean, I was duped. I didn't mean to sign up, but these scoundrels duped me. And I said, well, I wasn't really, because I am anti-Jim Crow. You know, I am anti-poll tax. I am for friendship with the Soviet Union, because this was signed during the war. But even then, I am for it. And so they said, yeah, but you could say the program will go off the air. I said, but I wasn't duped. And to this day, people say, Stud, you were so heroic to do it. They missed the whole point. Heroism had nothing to do with it. It was my ego. I think I'm pretty bright. I like myself. I hate to be considered a fool. And if I say I was duped, I'm just a goofball and a fool. I goof around a lot. But it was I think it's my most egotistical act was that one, not most heroic.
You've described yourself as an atheist.
An atheist?
Yeah.
Well, I lean toward agnosticism, which is, you know, is a cowardly atheist. that's what
not willing
more.
To completely
I'm an atheist, but as I get older, I start thinking, hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You know, that hourglass is thinning here. These vintage years, September song. Hold it, just a minute. I don't want to go yet. Just a minute. And so then your atheism is slightly diluted. But I am, I'd say, an atheist, yeah.
So it sounds that maybe as you get older, you're hedging your bets a little bit on atheism.
I might be. I'm not going to deny that. But I think, what do I want? Do I want cremation? Possibly. What happens afterwards? That's it. Bye-bye, the little snowflake who falls down and says, hey, look at me, I'm melting. There's a little poem, I forget who wrote that, Walter de la Mare or someone, a little one. And that's it, the flake. You want just a little touch of immortality.
Studs Terkel, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Studs Terkel's new book is Race. It's published by the New Press.